each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Hey everyone, God bless you for being here. This is Father Tom Kois, and time for brain wrinkling, as always. This is where it begins. Actually, I began this topic last week, and I'm just going to have to keep wrinkling your brain, actually. Whoa. Because
you just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, we're in interesting times, right? That's an old Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times.
Oh, but when will this mad whirlwind existence ever stop?
It will never stop until, let's see, the second coming of Christ, right? There is a very real sense of the madness and craziness, and we just all have to balance it with wisdom.
You're going to need a bigger boat.
We need a bigger boat. We need a wider understanding of God's revealed truth, his plan, his message for us. I guess what I'm leading up to, I didn't even mention exactly, and I'll say right off the top too, if you got my flock note, it's kind of like a Catholic tweet. If you got my flock note this morning, it's I posed the question, can you still say heresy? Is that term usable today in our church? It seems like we're moving away from it, of course, and there's a great fear of trying to point out certain heresies in the environment that has been created. Oh, I don't know since when, but it's certainly around now, the environment that we live in, that is a friend of relative truth, maybe I'll put it that way. We are all supposed to be a friend of the concept that truth is relative. So if truth is relative, then the concept of heresy is a heresy. You can't possibly declare something an erroneous teaching, an erroneous doctrine.
Oh, no!
Yeah, that's a new kind of development. Within theological circles, as it were. And I'll even say that it could come from good intentions. It could come from good intentions, the desire to avoid bitter arguments, bitter theological arguments. We don't want to hurt people. We don't want to destroy a delicate kind of balance or peace, as it were. But more and more we're getting to see that the peace that we think is there is not really a true and a deep peace. It's kind of a superficial peace. You know what I'm talking about. In regular work, regular life, we talk about walking on eggshells, right? We know what walking on eggshells means, especially with this person or that person. You have to walk on eggshells. What does that mean? That means you're going to avoid saying certain things because you're afraid that war will start or someone will run away, someone will attack. Something bad will happen, of course, you know, in a family situation that happens a lot. And in the world, the world community is a family situation. And so we've moved away from trying to study theology in such a way that we come to a great appreciation of what is wrong and what is right. The history of the Catholic Church since Jesus Christ has been sprinkled with many different declared heresies.
Wow.
It has.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Well, and those declared heresies often they're sort of the flip side of the declared doctrines, and denial of certain truths becomes errors. Theological errors become heresies. So, why is that on my brain, my friends? Because the Catholic Church is going to have a synod in Rome, and it's called the Pan-Amazonian Synod. It's starting next week, right around the corner. And I want to continue what I started last week because there's six issues, there's six topics, six very potential heresies that are a part of the working document that was given to the participants that are going to be together for 3 or 4 weeks. It's amazing that this issue of how to deal with Catholics in the Amazon jungle, the amount of time blocked off for such a conference, a synod, is longer than the conference that was had last February on the sex abuse issue. What does that mean? I'm not sure, but it doesn't seem right. certainly the people in the Amazon jungle need our love, need missionaries, need attention, need Christ. But why is it, why are 4 weeks dedicated to dealing with this? Something else is going on, my friends, and that's what I think is we need to be thinking about, being watchful for, praying about, that certain errors are corrected. Errors that are potentially, if not directly, contained in the working document. We got to go through that. Last week, if you remember, I started that off, and I said there were six of them, and I only got to one. The first one that I got to was this implicit pantheism. So that's, again, just to refresh your memory, the idea, it's very, very pre-Christianity to think that God is in the world, that the beauty, yeah, that's it. That's where, now let's see. I don't know. That was the door to the reward room, and I don't want to put someone who believes in pantheism in the reward room. But in order to see the danger of pantheism, that's worth the reward room. But unfortunately, this working document, in its desire to really highlight the spirituality of the Amazon Indian tribes, is promoting pantheism. I just have to say it that way. And remember, pantheism is that heresy which says that the divine is in the world, in the sense that mountains, trees, dogs, rivers, cats, and you and me are our God. We are the divine. The universe is the divine. There's no divine outside of the universe. is which is a fundamental key Catholic belief. You know, and of course, if you're not taught that,
you just wrinkled my brain, man.
We're probably going to have a lot of brain wrinkling going on here, but so if you're not taught that there is a God that created the universe and everything in it, including you and me, it's not readily experientially discovered. And so if you have a love for the universe and or your little corner of the universe, and most of us do, I like where I live, this is my home, this is my neighborhood, this is my school, this is my family, all these things that are part of our world. And you begin to see such goodness in the world around you, and it's understandable how one would declare that stuff that we're admiring and that we like, we would declare it to be God, to be the highest order of being, shall we say, the summum bonum, as we say in Latin. And yet it falls short. You can't possibly believe in a God who, if it's truly an idea of God, that is the universe or that is one and the same. So the Amazon Indian tribes remind me quite a bit of a lot of the Indian tribes of both North and South America in the days before Christianity came to this part of the world. And they are reminiscent very clearly of the paganism that existed before Jesus Christ came into the world. The modern experience of that is the missionaries dealing with the pagan Indian tribes of this side of the Atlantic. And so there is this, I'm going to try to bend over backwards, and it might hurt me, I might fall down, but I'm going to try to bend over backwards to try to see this working document in some kind of positive light, all right? Because I'm going to come back and criticize it quite a bit, but I feel I want to be like the great theological master Thomas Aquinas, who tries to understand the opposition position even better than those who profess the opposition position. If you know something about Thomas Aquinas and his way of writing, he always has a series it has been said, or it might be said, or this is an argument that has been put forth. And then he tries to describe the argument being put forth, and then he has an objection, and then he says why this or that is foolish or illogical or contradictory or things like that, to try to get deeper into the truth, which is very, very good way of learning, as it were. And so I'm going to try to bend over backwards and try to put those who are looking to bring Christ to the Amazon Indian tribes of Central America. How many tribes there are, I'm not sure, but there's got to be a lot of them. Tribes, by their very nature, are small. And tribes, by their very nature, don't join together. They are really extended families. In our modern sense of the word, you and I both know what our extended families are. It's a group of people that we see at weddings and funerals, basically. And most of us don't exactly know where the perimeter of that extended family exactly ends or begins, right? As you get out to the perimeters of the extended family, you begin to wonder, do I know you? I'm not sure. Are you part of? And we've all been there where someone says, oh, yes, I'm your second cousin thrice removed, or all that kind of good stuff. But we all, though we don't know the exact boundaries and the exact parameter of our extended family, we do know when there's two different extended families together that some belong to this one, some belong to that one, tribe A and tribe B. That's why there's a major difference between the extended family experience that we have at a funeral and the extended family we have at a wedding, right? Because a wedding, by its nature, is bringing two tribes together, two extended families together. And a funeral is basically the extended family of the person who died. Of course, they could overlap with many other people, but you get the idea. So anyways, a tribe or an extended family is by its nature not joined together into a larger kind of community, which the Bible, and so beautifully, one of my great theological heroes, Scott Hahn, describes very well in his Salvation History series.
Wow. You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Well, here it goes. It's even more, because then tribes get together, and when tribes unify, they become a nation. That's in essence kind of what God did with the people of Israel. They were tribes, the 12 tribes of Jacob, and when they were unified, you needed a new name, and then they became the 12 tribes of Israel, which was, of course, Jacob's new name that God gave him. So tribes are, by their very nature, fragmented, as it were. So how many Amazonian Indian tribes are there in South America? I don't know, but there's got to be a lot of them, and they most likely have different languages and different dialects, as it were. So I want to read to you a little bit of a wonderful book that I'm going through now called The Death Comes to the Archbishop, a very, very interesting book about the early days of missionary work around the U.S.-Mexican border, basically, is where it's set in. And I see something similar that I wish those who are going to participate in the synod would read this book and really understand, see the difference between what is described by those missionaries and the very real potential of heresy in what the working document is proposing for this present synod, okay? So stay right where you are. I'm Father Tom Coyes. You're listening to Listener Supported, The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
All right, pets, pipe down. I've got something to say to you. Yes, that means you too. Please tell your owners that Father Anthony would like to bless all of you on Saturday, October 5th from 1 p.m. till 6 p.m. with the pet blessing at 1:30 for the St. Francis of Assisi blessing of the animals. After all, it's Dogtoberfest at St. Stanislaus Kostka. It's free, and everyone is invited for an afternoon with their families and furry friends to enjoy liquid refreshments with adult brews and kid-friendly refreshments. There'll be canine demonstrations and food, too. Dogtoberfest at St. Stanislaus Kostka, Saturday, October 5th from 1 to 6 p.m. St. Stan's is located one block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway, for Dogtoberfest. And the goldfish are welcome, too.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka is the sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, where you can enter into the presence of Christ 24/7. Every first Saturday afternoon will be a special opportunity for healing. At 4:30, bring your petitions for our Blessed Mother's intercession as we pray the Rosary. Then, at 5, we share the body of Christ in the Holy Mass. Also, at 5:30, a Spanish Mass, followed by a Eucharistic procession, adoration, the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and an anointing. Enter into the sacred space of St. Stanislaus Kostka and place yourself before Christ for healing on first Saturday afternoon starting at 4:30
Find St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, two blocks north of Division, on Noble, just off the Kennedy in Chicago. And find peace and healing.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Father Tom Coyce here with you to contemplate and I'm issuing an important warning, and I'm offering some counsel. Okay, so the warning is: watch out for heresies that can be possibly promulgated by the Vatican, which is a very strange thing to say, but it's possible if the synod on the Amazonian Indian tribes makes certain kinds of declarations that are called for in this working document. I'm going to say too again that at this point, my fellow seekers of truth and my fellow believers, at this point, I'm going to say ambiguity can be our friend. Ambiguity can be our friend. Because if certain theological dissertations, narratives, are written ambiguously, they're not as dangerous because they can be interpreted different ways. And so if the authoritative branch called the Magisterium of the Church issues some kind of statement that is not clear, then it can be very dangerous because the populace will interpret it the way it wants. But those others who understand that a wrong interpretation is a wrong interpretation will have to correct the ambiguity or correct the wrong interpretation thereof. Are you following me? So ambiguity can be weaponized because it's thrown a particular theological concept is thrown out purposely, ambiguously, because those who throw it out know what the popular interpretation of that particular principle, theological principle, philosophical, perhaps moral principles, these things. They know how the popular sentiment, the most of the people are going to interpret it, they want it to be interpreted that way as opposed to a different interpretation. Okay, so what am I getting at? Like the idea of pantheism, I started with that one because that's the first issue that is brought up as a concern over the working document. Is there something true, according to our Catholic faith and the doctrines that we've held for 2,000 years? Is there something true about saying you can find the divine within nature? Absolutely. It's very true. Looking at the stars, looking at an insect, or looking at a snowflake, all these things about nature can lead one to the idea of God. Yet the pagan pantheistic concept is not saying that these things lead you to the divine, lead you to an appreciation of the author and the creator of it all. There becomes a warped or an injunction to worship these things, to call these things God. That's why in the Old Testament, the ideas of the idols that we don't really deal with today, you know, a statue of a half man, half dog, or half lion and whatever, you know, the bull, the famous statue of the bull that the people of Israel made out of gold when Moses was up on top of the mountain. You know, these things cannot be worshipped as you worship something of in this world as a divine, you are insulting the true God who made the whole universe. And so this pantheism is a heresy. But studying what people say, those who are pantheists, as they would say, they need to be corrected. Something of goodness and beauty and truth is found, but it's corrupted with falsities and the wrong conclusions. That's the nature of this problem of the working document, the nature of these six very potential heresies contained in the working document. So, but I told you before the break that I wanted to read, there's a little segment in the book, Death Comes to the Archbishop, which is it's a very beautiful story about a French priest who is sent to, basically it's northern Mexico and actually southern United States. The Mexican-American War happens while he's out there, and of course that changed the map quite a bit. So what used to be Mexico is now the United States. And he has difficulty, of course, trying to get all around the area. And Santa Fe, the old town that still exists, of course, now down there, one of the oldest places, towns in the United States now, which was before it was part of Mexico. As a matter of fact, the very town, I should throw this at you too, because I found it very interesting. The very town named Santa Fe is a replica, a duplicate of a European town. If you haven't discovered that, my friends, you're living under a rock, because we have New York, which is a replica of York in England. We have New Mexico. Well, that's a obviously reference to Mexico. There's all sorts of towns. New Glarus, one of my favorite little towns in southern Wisconsin, if you've ever been up there, a beautiful little town with the William Tell Festival that goes on up there. And this is the time to go up that way to get some good apple picking done in the fall. Anyways, of course, there's lots of towns in the United States that are named like or similar to those in Europe. And Santa Fe from New Mexico is no exception. And the town of Santa Fe in Spain is very historically interesting, because it was the town that was established when, right at the break of the Muslim domination in Spain, as the Spaniards tried to regain Spain for Catholicism, they especially under Queen Isabella, fortified or got together the army and sieged. They built a town to siege the town where the Muslims were primarily headquartered, as it were. And it worked. The Muslims fell, and that makeshift town that Queen Isabella kind of created by sending the army there became Santa Fe. She says, "We will name this town Santa Fe, the Holy Faith." Many people said to her, "Well, you should call it Isabellaville, or name it after yourself." And she, being a pious Catholic person with the humility of a good soul, said, "I'm not going to name the city after myself. We'll name it Santa Fe." So anyways, the story of the book, Death Comes to the Archbishop, is set in and around the town of Santa Fe and northern Mexico and southern United States in those turbulent 1800s. And so there's this one scene that I said, "Oh, I gotta share this with my listeners, because it's what I pray those who are going to the Amazon Synod would reflect on. The missionaries, the Catholic missionaries, in the book were primarily French, but of course there were Spaniard missionaries as well. At this point in time, in the 1840s, 1850s, of course that's right around the Spanish-American War, Mexican-American War, and you know the difference between this Mexican-American War and the Spanish-American War, right? You could get those. The Mexican-American War was the war fought over the border, to establish the border that we have today, basically the Rio Grande, right, and the south border of the United States. That's so much in the news today. That was the Mexican-American War. The Spanish-American War happened right at the 1900s. That was when Theodore Roosevelt kind of got famous. He was in the army at the time, and he charged up. As the Mexicans kicked out the Spaniards from Mexico, and the Spaniards were like, "Well, what are we going to hold on to?" They were holding on to Florida, of course, for a good while, but eventually, us Americans got rid of them up down there, and so the last holdout of Spain in the New World, as we call it, was the battle over was the war of Spanish-American War, where Puerto Rico and Cuba, all that those Caribbean islands were fought over. Anyways, so here I got to set the scene. The Archbishop is a kind man. Well, he's not old yet. He has to deal with a number of priests that he finds there. He's named the Archbishop, and he's sent there from France. Okay, you're going to have to create a you're going to have to create diocese and then the archdiocese, and you have to go visit the people. And of course, that the area was populated by many what? Pagan tribes, Indian tribes. But in the 1840s, you're already almost 400 years after Columbus came, and some of the early missionaries planted the seeds of Catholicism within many Indian tribes. But of course, those seeds, some took good root, others didn't take that much good root. And the Indian tribes at the time this is logical in a sense. They're constantly combining their old pagan rituals and beliefs with Catholic rituals and beliefs. It was a tough job, no doubt about it, I'm sure. There's stories of some of the Indians and their propensity for blood sacrifices. They would conduct Easter celebrations with Good Friday, where they would actually nail human beings to the cross in order to, and some guys would die, of course, if that was done. And so the missionaries had to say, well, wait a minute. Okay, yes, you heard about the Passion of Christ. You know that Jesus rises from the dead, okay, or maybe they didn't get the whole Paschal mystery down so well, but they sure tried to imitate and recreate Good Friday by such a crazy way. And then there's also so many superstitions, of course, right? Superstitions regarding what will heal you, curses and blessings, I guess, is really basically what it comes down to. You find these kinds of things in all these pagan tribal religions and spiritualities. And this is the danger that Cardinal Burke and those who are issuing a warning regarding the synod to watch out for such slippery theological, this slippery spirituality, as it were. Okay, so Nick wants me to take another little break. And I promise you...
You just wrinkled my brain,
there you go. I promise you, when we get back, we'll get to this beautiful little narrative in Death Comes to the Archbishop, because it's part of my counsel to those who will participate in this synod. So you're gonna have to listen to this podcast, my friends, and share it with everyone there. Anyways, I'm Father Tom Coyce. You're listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
You're invited to the Falling into the Rhythm Dinner Dance for St. Stanislaus Kostka, Saturday, October 12th.
Walking in rhythm, moving in sound.
There will be an open bar and a family-style dinner at Regency Inn Banquets, 5319 West Diversity in Chicago. Tickets are $70 per person to benefit St. Stanislaus Kostka. Order those tickets online at ststanschurch.org/events. For the Falling into Rhythm Dinner Dance, Saturday, October 12th from 6 p.m. till midnight.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stan's School has an amazing PK 3 through 8th grade program focused on leadership and social-emotional learning, and is one of the only schools to implement the Reading and Writing Project of Columbia University and the University of Chicago. Everyday math across the board, PK 3 through 8th, is taught by our highly educated and dedicated teachers. St. Stan's students are academically challenged with advanced-level placement opportunities as their test scores and high school admissions speak volumes. St. Stan's is an integral part of the Wicker Park community, where you feel welcome and at home with other families and friends who enjoy the same warm, friendly, and safe atmosphere for their children. We have small classroom size, which makes a difference in the whole learning experience. Many schools have excellent programs. At St. Stan's, we empower students to be excellent. Join the St. Stan's family. It is a selective admissions process. Grades 1 through 8 are tested and interviewed. Call 773-278-4560. That's 773-278-4560. Or stop by at 1255 North Noble Street. That's one block north of Division, just off the Kennedy. More information at ststanschicago.org. That's ststanschicago.org.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. I'm trying to bend your brain a little bit regarding some of the very potential theological errors that are included in the Amazon Synod coming up in Rome. There's a little scene in the book, Death Comes to the Archbishop, that I think is applicable to this situation, because it's a story about Catholic missionaries in northern Mexico, southern United States, and some of the challenges that all missionaries do face, of course. And trying to bend over backwards to give at least some modicum of positive regard to the desire to help the Amazonian Indian tribes come closer to Christ. That being said, beware of the errors that have to be corrected, and that's going to be the key factor of this synod. Will the errors be corrected? Will they be pointed out? Will they be brought along in the correct way, or will they just be will they be codified? And will the synod in general just be a doorway to achieve in the universal church something that many people are calling for, namely women priests and married priests? That's one of the quote hidden agendas that's really not so hidden. So anyways, here's this little segment. We got this younger priest talking with his bishop. They're both about the same age, but the younger French priest has been there longer, and he knows the people very well. And the younger priest got hurt and come down with a bad fever. He's brought to the bishop's home to recuperate. And as he's recuperating there, he comes with this, he figures he's praying to the Lord, and he wants do something. If God grants him health, he's going to do something great for God. You know, a beautiful sentiment, as we all should imitate that. And so anyways, here it is. The younger curate, the younger priest, Father Joseph, says, he smiles to remember a long time ago when he was a young curate in Puy de Dôme in France, how he planned a season of special devotion to the Blessed Virgin Mary for the month of May, and how the old priest with whom he lived and to whom he was an assistant had blasted his hopes by cold disapproval. So the young, he's remembering, he's recuperating in May in northern Mexico near Santa Fe. And he's remembering the beautiful days when he was young and he wanted to make a beautiful May for Mary. Back in France, the old priest said, hogwash. brings back memories in my mind too, as often. The narrative continues, it goes, the old man had come through the terror, had been trained in the austerity of those days of the persecution of the clergy. He's, of course, referring to the French Revolution and the Reign of Terror, where so many priests and catechists and nuns and noblemen and all the rest were sent to the guillotine, right? If you remember that part of history. So anyways, back in the young priest is having this idyllic vision. Okay, let's have a beautiful month for May, Mary in May. Let's make all sorts of altars with beautiful flowers and all the rest. So the older priest who had been through the Reign of Terror, he was trained in the austerity of those days of the persecution of the clergy, and which means don't be so giddy about making beautiful altars with flower arrangements. You know, come on. Serious things going on here. We have to overcome. That propensity. And the narrative continues that he was not untouched by Jansenism. Jansenism was, it was and is a heresy as well, that oftentimes is associated with those who are too strict, shall we say. And I think Pope Francis thinks that Jansenism is one of the biggest problems, where there's too much strictness. I'm not sure. Maybe in his world there is, but I don't. I think the laxity is a much bigger problem than strictness. But Jansenism, you could see how Jansenism would be associated with, let us say, those priests who went through the French Revolution, and they realized people are being killed for their faith, especially because those who were killing the priests and the catechists and the nuns, they were celebrating. They didn't like Catholicism because of its prohibition on so much fun. Those who were wildly in favor of the revolution were wildly in favor of free sex and free drinking and anything else that you can get away with that would be part of the fun of life. And so those who were being executed could understandably move toward that spirit of Jansenism, which says all dancing is evil, all drinking is evil, you know, all sex is evil, that kind of thing. But of course, that's not what Orthodox Catholicism teaches. You could see that happens in different Protestant denominations as well, of course, too, right? But anyways, okay, so back to the narrative where we get the point for our synod coming up. He says, the young Father Joseph bore his rebuke with meekness, the rebuke of that French pastor he was with, and sadly went to his own chamber. There he took his rosary and spent the entire day in prayer. Not according to my desires, but if it is for thy glory, grant me this wish, O Mary, my hope. So the young priest prays. In the evening of that same day, the old pastor sent for him and unsolicited, granted him the request he had so sternly denied in the morning. How joyfully Father Joseph had written all this to his sister Philomena when a pupil with the nuns of the Visitation in their native Rion, begging her to make him a quantity of artificial flowers for his May altar. So you can see the picture. He's remembering, dreaming back in Rome, how one of his dreams was to do something nice for Mary. And so he does. So, okay, but then he kind of recovers. He recovers his strength and his health good enough. The archbishop, the main character, who's called Father Latour in this beautiful book, the archbishop is very glad to have another priest with him, and he wants to build a cathedral and everything, and so he really wants the young priest, Father Joseph, to be with him and help him here. And but in his recuperating, he has this dream of doing something great for the natives. And here's where I do believe, I think we should, Father moved uneasily under his blankets, it's Father Joseph, to hunt for lost Catholics, utterly lost Catholics, down in your new territory, towards Tucson. There are hundreds of poor families down there who have never seen a priest. I want to go from house to house this time, to every little settlement. They are full of devotion and faith, and it has nothing to feed upon but the most mistaken superstitions. They remember their prayers all wrong. They cannot read, and since there is no one to instruct them, how can they get it right? They are like seeds, full of germination, but with no moisture. A mere contact is enough to make them a living part of the church. So the young priest is talking about his missionary zeal, though something must be admitted as different between what this story about the missionaries in northern Mexico in the 1880s and the missionaries who would go to the Amazon tribes today in modern times. Those Indians who had some faith and mixed with superstition had seeds of Catholicism planted for years and years, generations perhaps, hundreds of years since the time of Columbus and the earliest missionaries. The Amazonian tribes don't even have that. And so their superstition is not really mixed with the seeds of the faith. So, okay, Nick wants me to take another break here, so I will do that because we run a tight ship, and I'm going to finish this little narrative, and then we're going to go a little bit more to these important potential heresies, as we say. Okay, I'm Father Tom Coyes. You're listening to Listener Supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Will you say yes? Our Lady is looking for patrons. In 1999, the Blessed Mother asked the St. Stanislaus Kostka Parish, open the doors. And so we did. St. Stanislaus Kostka Parish is now open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, providing all people a place of prayer, a quiet sanctuary from the noise of the world to adore the living God and hear His voice. In 2007, Francis Cardinal George designated St. Stanislaus Kostka the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy for Chicago. Since that time, we have been faithful to the call to be a place of spiritual sanctuary for those seeking God and His mercy. The cost of keeping our doors open 24 hours a day is considerable, to say nothing of the cost of maintaining this beautiful and historic church in the heart of Chicago. We are asking you to consider becoming a patron of the Blessed Mother, promising God and the Blessed Mother a weekly donation of $20 or more for at least 1 year to support the call to open the doors. As a patron, you will know that you have answered Our Lady's call to keep the doors open and be remembered at Patrons' Masses on the second Sunday of the month at St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy. Will you accept Our Lady's invitation and join the Patrons of the Blessed Mother? Go to ststandschurch.org, that's ststandschurch.org, and click on the Donations tab, and click Patron on the drop-down. God bless you.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is the official sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. Founded by Polish immigrants in the late 1800s, this historic church is more commonly known as St. Stan's. One church, many cultures, in that masses are held in English, Spanish, and Polish. The church is two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy. St. Stan's has been so prominent in the history of the church in Chicago that the Kennedy Expressway was even built around it. St. Stan's is easy to get to. It is the sanctuary for quiet prayer before the celebrated iconic monstrance. For Mass and confession times and special events, please visit our new website at ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. And while you're on the homepage, feel free to click on the Donations tab to help in the continuing restoration of St. Stan's.
Hey, welcome everyone. We're in the middle of a very beautiful book called Death Comes to the Archbishop. And there's a little scene in this that I think is very appropriate as we contemplate the issues of missionary work in Native Indians, especially those that are mixed with pagan and heretical theological beliefs, as it were, without not receiving the catechism, not receiving the indoctrination that is part of knowing a truth. You know, that sense of even that word indoctrination is kind of people resist it. They don't like hearing indoctrination because it sounds like you're imposing your beliefs upon someone else. And if we as a church were imposing our own private beliefs, that would be a no-no. But the real meaning of indoctrination is imposing what was revealed to us by God Himself. That's the essence of indoctrination. I'm going to share this truth with you because it was given to me by God. That's why so many people resist belief and religious practice. They think that's just so arrogant. However, witness what they believe. It's not that they don't believe you can believe in something. It's just that they don't want to believe in what Catholicism is teaching or Christianity is teaching. There are committed environmentalists. There are committed spiritualists in many different ways, believing in these potions and rituals. That's one of the things that obviously Amazon Indian tribes incorporated into their religion, and they believe in them just as strongly, as it were. And sometimes they will kill if they sense missionaries are coming to take those beliefs away from them. And so the idea of doctrines, the idea of heresies, the idea of a universal truth is got to be part of our spirituality, my friends. We've lost a lot of that. Okay, so here we are. We're in the middle of the 1800s, and the book that I'm reading from is Death Comes to the Archbishop. And the young curate, the young priest, is sharing his vision and desire to want to go to the most difficult Indian tribes. He says this to his bishop, you know, a mere contact is enough to make them a living part of the church. You know, even if I go and visit with them, and they'll know I'm a priest, and they'll appreciate, their faith will grow. He says, the more I work with the Mexicans, the more I believe it was people like them our Savior bore in mind when he said, unless ye become as little children. He was thinking of people who are not clever in the things of this world, whose minds are not upon gain and worldly advancement. These poor Christians are not thrifty like our country people back home. They have no veneration for property, no sense of material values. I stop a few hours in a village. I administer the sacraments and hear confessions. I leave in every house some little token, a rosary or a religious picture, and I go away feeling that I have conferred immeasurable happiness and have released faithful souls that were shut away from God by neglect. How I have to share in my little experience of being in some of the very primitive areas of Mexico not long ago, when I was associated with the missionary sisters and priests of the Consagrados del Santísimo Salvador. Maybe you remember Father Pablo Straub, the founder of that very nice, wonderful community. I remember how even in our modern time, you would go to a little village, you'd pass out a holy card, and they would receive them with such great joy, and that even the young teenagers would gather around to grab one. You know, if I had 20 holy cards and there were 30 people there, the 10 that didn't get them were very sad. It was very touching. It was very beautiful. That's what this narrative is getting to. But the key part here, I want to keep going on a little bit more. Let's see. So he goes to the little town and he's talking about, he's talking with a native Indian, and the native Indian grabs the priest's hands and he brings them to a secret cave, and he shows them golden chalice and vestments and cruets, all the paraphernalia for celebrating Mass. His ancestors has hidden these sacred objects there when the mission was sacked by the Apache Indians. He did not know how many generations ago, so he brought them to a cave. Maybe 200 years that the missionaries were there, and they still had a glimmer of the Catholic faith in their hearts. This secret had been handed down in his family, and I was the first priest who had ever come to restore to God his own. To me, that is the situation in a parable. The faith in that wild frontier is like a buried treasure. They guard it, but they do not know how to use it to their soul's salvation. A word, a prayer, a service is all that is needed to set free those souls in bondage. I confess I am covetous of that mission. I desire to be the man who restores these lost children to God. It will be the greatest happiness of my life. The bishop did not reply at once to this appeal. At last, he said gravely, you must realize that I have need of you here, Father Joseph. My duties are too many for one man. But you do not need me so much as they do. Father Joseph threw off his coverings and sat up in his cassock, putting his feet on the ground. Any one of your good French priests from Montferrand can serve you here. It is work that can be done by intelligence. But down there in the jungle, there is the work for the heart, for particular sympathy. And none of your new priests understand those poor their natures as I do. I have almost become a Mexican. I have learned to like chili colorado and mutton fast. Their foolish ways no longer offend me. Their very faults are dear to me. I am their man. That can and should be the attitude of the Amazon City, but I'm afraid it won't be, my friends. Let's keep praying and let's keep abreast of what's going on in the church around us. I'm Father Tom Coyce. This is listener supported WNDC.
Do we search deep for truth or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? Thank you. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed.